like bitterness in her voice. But I didn't. It was all his doing. She added in a low voice as if to herself, with my money. Ophelia leaned forward. Was that the reason for the divorce? Divorce? Buddy straightened, blinking. You and Mr. Whitworth were thinking of... No, not at all, Mrs. Whitworth said quickly. She looked at Ophelia, her eyes dark. I don't know where you got that silly idea, Mrs. Snow, but it's not true. Her voice went up a notch. Really? Not in the very slightest. Ophelia looked startled, then contrite. Oops. Sorry. She ducked her head, embarrassed. The gossip in this town is just... Well, there's enough to drown a horse, that's for sure. Listen long enough and you'll hear just about everything under the sun, no matter how ridiculous. I do sincerely apologize. Thank you, Mrs. Whitworth said softly, and leaned over to pat Ophelia's hand. It's not one bit important, really. I just wouldn't want the sheriff to get the wrong idea, that's all. Buddy looked from one of them to the other. He had always been a pretty good reader of people's reactions. He would swear that Ophelia had been right in the first place, and Mrs. Whitworth was pretending she was wrong, and Ophelia was pretending to agree, and that both of them understood exactly what was going on. But he was more interested in her remark about Mr. Whitworth's business arrangement with Bodine Pyle, because he knew that Pyle's moonshine camp was somewhere in Briar Swamp, not more than a couple of miles from where the accident occurred. Buddy cleared his throat. How long had your husband been Pyle's partner? I don't know. I only found out about it a couple of weeks ago. Mrs. Whitworth took a cigarette out of a silver bowl on a table beside her. I think it had something to do with Pyle wanting to expand his business after that other man was arrested. That other man? Buddy asked, frowning. And then he understood. Mrs. Whitworth was talking about Mickey Ledoux, who for years had run a highly professional moonshine production and distribution business out of a wooded hollow on Dead Cow Creek in the hills west of Darling. Ledoux's moonshine had generally been vouchsafed the best in this part of the state, but Mickey had been put out of business by Chester P. Kennard, a revenue agent who had made it his mission to shut Mickey down. It was a sad story. Mickey's youngest brother was dead, shot by the revenue agents in Kennard's posse, and Mickey had been sentenced to the Wetumpka State Penitentiary. But Mickey's loss had been Bodine Pyle's gain, and it wasn't more than a few days before Cypress County had another supplier. Pyle had long been Mickey's fiercest competitor, and he used whatever tricks came handiest to gain a bigger piece of the market. His whiskey didn't pack the notorious Ledoux punch, but it didn't cost as much, and for folks who had to choose between a new pair of boots and a couple of bottles of White Lightning, a cheap drunk was as good as a pricey one. When Mickey was hauled off to Wetumpka, Pyle had expanded his operation. In fact, Darling whispered that Pyle was getting some investment money somewhere, although nobody knew exactly where. And nobody really wanted to guess, because the less you knew about Bodine Pyle's business arrangements, the better off you were. Ah, Buddy said, feeling that he was moving toward an understanding of something, although he wasn't sure what it was. Did Pyle ever come here to discuss this with your husband? The skin on the back of his neck was prickling, but he made his voice light and casual. He didn't want her to think that his questions held any special significance. Once, Mrs. Whitworth said, not looking at him, she pulled on her cigarette. But my husband preferred to meet him somewhere else. People talk, you know. He understood what she was not saying. Whitworth wouldn't have wanted his ritzy neighbors on Peachtree Street to see a known moonshiner dropping in every so often. It would make more sense for him to meet Pyle out at the Briar Swamp operation, which might explain what Whitworth was doing on that road. I see, he said again, but in a different tone. Mrs. Whitworth had a lot to deal with right now, and he didn't want to upset the lady. but what they were talking about was against the law. Against several laws, actually. Roy Burns had done what he could to keep foreign moonshiners, non-local bootleggers, from setting up shop in the county. They brought in crime and violence, he said, and it was true. But Roy had been a man of compassion, and he'd left the locals pretty much alone. It was, after all, a simple matter of economics. Corn was selling right now for no better than 50 cents a bushel, less than it cost to raise it. But that bushel of corn would yield 3 gallons of shine, which would sell for $12 a gallon. $12 a gallon. But he could remember Roy's exact words. They can cook up whatever the hell they want out there in those camps, so long as they live decent and don't bother me none. Some of them couldn't feed their kids if they couldn't shine. Of course, the shiners and their families were Cypress County voters, so Buddy suspected that there was more to Roy's tolerance than simple compassion. But that wasn't his approach. In the short time he'd been sheriff, he had already arrested Pootie McKay and dumped out the 80 gallons of bootleg tiger spit he was carrying. Prohibition had been repealed, but that didn't make unlicensed and untaxed moonshine legal. And the key word here was tax, for the feds were collecting a whopping $2 tax on every gallon of whiskey. The 80 gallons that Pootie was hauling amounted to $160 that didn't find its way into Uncle Sam's pockets. Of course, dumping out all that perfectly fine shine hadn't made Buddy many friends, but a lawman who worried too much about votes probably wasn't doing his job. Nervously, Mrs. Whitworth blew out a stream of smoke. "I wouldn't want you to think that my husband's arrangement with Pyle was something I encouraged." She seemed to be choosing her words carefully. "I wasn't any too happy about it when I found out. I wouldn't want anyone else to know."
"I can imagine,"
Ophelia said quietly. "I'm sure it must have bothered you," Buddy said, feeling that this was a substantial understatement. He cleared his throat. "Say, is it okay if I use your phone? I need to call Lionel Noonan and find out when you can go over there and see your husband." Mrs. Whitworth's eyes widened.
Do I have to see him?"
she whispered faintly. She held out an appealing hand to Buddy.
"I am so sorry, Sheriff, but if you made me go over there, I'm afraid you would just have to carry me out. I couldn't bear to look at my grandmother when she was laid out in her coffin."
She closed her eyes and brought her hand to her forehead.
"Just the thought of it makes me feel..."
Alarmed, Buddy said, "No, of course you don't have to see him, not if you don't want to." He wondered if Ophelia could locate that bottle of smelling salts in a hurry.
"And please don't feel sorry about it," Ophelia said quickly. "You just do whatever you can do."
She gave Buddy a cautionary glance and put an arm around Mrs. Whitworth's shoulder. "Mr. Noonan will be glad to come over here and discuss funeral arrangements with you any time you feel up to it," she added soothingly. "Give him a call and let him know, and if I can do anything for you, let me know."
"Thank you," Mrs. Whitworth said in a muffled voice. "You're terribly kind, both of you. I appreciate it more than I can say."
A few minutes later, Buddy and Ophelia were in his sheriff's car heading back into town.
"My goodness,"
Ophelia said, puffing out her breath. "That was informative, wasn't it?" "What sort of information did you get out of it?" Buddy asked, sliding a glance at her. One thing he had learned about women, they saw things a whole lot differently than he did. He could be in the same room with a woman, listening to the same conversation, but then come to find out the conversation she heard wasn't the same one he had heard.
"Well, for one thing," Ophelia replied thoughtfully, "she didn't seem too surprised when you told her about the accident. I mean, she was upset, of course, and maybe she was sort of expecting something, since he hadn't been home all night."
Without hesitating, she added,
"And she told a lie, just a little one, but it was still a lie.
I wasn't going to contradict her to her face, but she did tell me she planned to get a divorce.
Did she really? Buddy said, interested.
Ophelia nodded. We drove over to Monroeville the other day, in her new car, actually. We stopped for something to drink, and she told me about the divorce. In fact, she even said she had talked to Mr. Mosley about it. He's advising her.
Buddy wasn't terribly surprised. People seem to be getting divorces awfully easily these days. But he found himself puzzled.
She said she didn't want me to get the wrong idea, but you're saying she lied. Why?
If she was planning on getting a divorce, why did she say she wasn't?
Because she didn't want you to wonder whether she might have a motive.
A motive for what? Buddy asked, now more puzzled than ever. He felt like a schoolboy who knew he was missing an essential part of the lesson, but had no idea what it was or what page it was on. If there was a right idea, he hadn't got it.
With a wave of her hand, Ophelia went on as though she hadn't heard his question. And because, now that he's dead, she'd like us, or maybe just me, to think that her reason for wanting a divorce is irrelevant, just a little piece of history that doesn't matter any longer.
She tilted her head thoughtfully.
Which, of course, might not be true. It might actually be important.
But he still felt puzzled.
Well, I don't exactly.
He stopped.
Why was she getting a divorce?
Ophelia thought about that.
She didn't say why, actually, and I didn't ask.
A divorce is awfully personal, don't you think? And I don't really know her well enough to be her confidant. She was talking to me because she felt she just had to talk to someone, and I happened to be handy.
Another pause.
But she said something that made me think it might have to do with money. She had a lot of it, you know, from her grandmother, that fierce-looking lady in the portrait over the love seat.
Buddy slowed to let Mr. Snip's ancient black-and-brown coonhound amble across the road in front of him.
You had to be careful in Darling, where there were as many dogs as there were people, and some of the dogs were old as Moses and blind as bats. If he damaged that coonhound, Mr. Snip would never forgive him. When the hound was safely on the curb, Buddy accelerated again.
I guess I heard word of an inheritance, he said cautiously, a long time ago.
You said she had money. She doesn't have it now. Did she lose it in the crash?
In Buddy's admittedly limited experience, that was the main reason for Darling folk going broke. And even if you didn't have money invested in the stock market, Black Tuesday changed your life. Any American citizen who had been alive on that day and in the weeks right afterward would remember it forever.
The crash?
Ophelia pursed her lips.
I have no idea, honestly. But that house doesn't look like a lot of money, do you think? I mean, it's nice enough, but it's really pretty dinky. Nothing like the Vaudier plantation. And, of course, she did buy that new Dodge from Kilgore's. But if I had her kind of money, I'd have a bigger house over by the country club. And more help in the house. She's just got Desiree, who does everything but the laundry. You'd think she could afford more, wouldn't you?
Well, Buddy was about to say that the house looked like $1 million to him, although he didn't have a lot of familiarity with the price of real estate. And he had absolutely no idea how many maids a woman ought to have or how much she ought to pay them. But Ophelia was rattling on.
Come to think of it, I wonder why the Whitworths aren't living on the Vaudier plantation. Her grandmother's place, you know. I've seen pictures of that mansion. It's fabulous, really fabulous. I've never heard that she sold it, but I suppose she did.
She rolled down the car window and let the breeze blow through her hair.
Why don't you ask Mr. Mosley, Buddy?
Like I said, he's her lawyer.
Ask Mr. Mosley what?
Buddy said helplessly, feeling as if he had totally lost track of the conversation.
Ophelia turned to face him, both eyebrows raised. Why she wanted a divorce, of course. And what happened to the money? I wasn't curious before, but I am now. I think you should ask him. See what he says. I'll bet it would be interesting.
Well, if that was what she was talking about, Buddy had an answer.
No,
he
he said firmly. I am not going to ask Mr. Mosley. I don't see how Mrs. Whitworth's wanting a divorce because of money or any other reason is connected to Mr. Whitworth's accidentally killing himself by going too fast down Spook Hill.
Ophelia said. Well, you just never know, you know.
She put her hand on his arm. Watch out, buddy. There's Mrs. Vanderroy, poor old thing. I'll bet she doesn't know where she is. He slowed again. Mrs. Vanderroy was standing uncertainly at the corner, clutching her sweater, her gray hair hanging down over her shoulders like a tangle of fuzzy wool yarn. The old lady had a habit of wandering off whenever she was able to get out of the house by herself. But then he saw her daughter hurrying after her, so he figured she would fetch her mother home. He and Ophelia waved at the pair as he drove on.
Anyway, he said to Ophelia, Mr. Mosley can't talk to people about his client's business. There's some sort of rule about that.
He knew that sometimes the rule could be broken, but he didn't know why or how, and he wasn't going to bother Mr. Mosley by asking. Ophelia wasn't listening.
I happen to know that he's in Montgomery this week, she went on. But Liz Lacey is in the office. She might know something about this money thing. Why don't you talk to her, Buddy?
Buddy sighed. Some women just can't take no for an answer. They were approaching the courthouse square, and he changed the subject.
A minute ago, you said that Mrs. Whitworth's lying about the divorce business was one thing. What was the other thing?
Ophelia gave him a look.
You mean to say you didn't notice?
Notice what?
That bruise on her face and the scrape.
I saw it, Buddy said, but I didn't.
She covered it up with makeup,
Ophelia said knowingly.
A lot of makeup.
Really?
Not only did women hear different things than he did, they saw different things. He had noticed the bruise, of course, but he hadn't thought much about it.
Really? If it weren't for that, it would look much worse. Just looking at that bruise, I'd say that somebody hit her a good lick, Ophelia said. On the other hand, that scrape, maybe she fell. And she was wearing long sleeves, so we couldn't see what her arms looked like.
She chuckled wryly.
Listen, Buddy, whatever you do, do not get in an automobile with that woman under the wheel. She is the worst driver I have ever seen. She's been taking driving lessons from that salesman at Kilgore's, but you certainly can't tell it. She drives like a maniac.
I'll try to remember that.
Buddy turned the corner at Hart's Peerless Laundry. Do you want to go back to the newspaper office, or are you headed home?
The office will be fine, Ophelia said. She squinted at him. You're not going to talk to Liz?
I don't have a reason to talk to her. Buddy said firmly.
He pulled up in front of the dispatch. I'm going to the sheriff's office and see if Wayne is back from Noonan's yet. One way or another, he and his deputy spent a fair amount of time with Lionel Noonan, who owned the only funeral parlor in town. Banks could fail, stores could go bankrupt, even the county could go broke, and you might not know until a bridge went out and nobody came to fix it. But the funeral parlor was probably the most essential business in the entire town. Everybody who died had to go there, like it or not. And folks always said that Lionel Noonan could be relied on to do the right thing by a funeral, with the corpse looking as nice as possible under the circumstances, and flowers and music and all the rest. Lionel always said that a funeral was a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. He never wanted to disappoint any of his clients.
Well, if you won't, maybe I will.
Ophelia opened the car door.
Thanks for letting me go along, Buddy. Like I said, it was informative.
Buddy nodded. He thought she was probably right, although he wasn't sure exactly what he was going to do with the few scraps of information he had picked up. Chapter 16. Deputy Springer offers a theory. The sheriff's office was located a few doors west of the courthouse square in a converted house behind Snow's Farm Supply. The dilapidated old place had been repossessed by the Darling Savings and Trust a couple of years before, then sold to Cypress County so the sheriff would have some place to hang his hat, as Roy Burns had put it. If nothing else, the office had a convenient location. It was next door to the Darling Jail, two shoebox-sized cells upstairs over Snow's farm supply. If Buddy wanted to climb the outside stairs and see if old Pete Peavy had recovered from his weekend drunk, it was handy. Buddy parked the sheriff's car in front of the office and went up the front porch steps. The resident tomcat, black as the pit, stared balefully at him from the railing, eyes glowing like burning copper. Nobody knew where the cat had come from, and nobody remembered seeing him around town, which was strange, since most of the town's cats belonged to somebody, or to several somebodies, since philandering tomcats are generous with their patronage. This one, the scarred veteran of many wars, had shown up the day after they hauled the late Roy Burns out of Horsetail Gorge. In a quavering voice, Jed Snow had joked that the cat was Roy's ghost, come back to haunt us. But Buddy thought that it was unlikely that mere haunting was involved. He thought it was more probable that Roy had arranged for the animal to watch the new sheriff and report back when he didn't do things right. He had named him the Beast. Buddy opened the screen door, which was loose on its hinge and crooked. "You coming in?" he asked the Beast, holding the door. The cat considered, stretched, deliberately dragging it out to make Buddy wait, then leaped lightly down to the floor and went inside. To get a little more space, Buddy and Wayne had knocked out the plaster wall between the small living room and the minuscule dining room, turning them into a single reception area with a couple of wooden folding chairs against a wall and a pine-topped counter across the middle. They hadn't gotten around to painting the walls all one color yet, and the red and blue checked wallpaper in the back section clashed with the pink cabbage roses in the front. One door opened onto the small bedroom that was Wayne's office. Another led to the front bedroom, now Buddy's office. The kitchen was their meeting room and work room. The deputy's job paid peanuts, so besides being their office, the house did double duty as Wayne's living quarters. There was an icebox and a little electric Fidelity rangette in the kitchen, where Wayne made grilled cheese sandwiches and cooked his supper. Buddy's, too, sometimes. As a bachelor cook, Wayne's preferences ran to corned beef hash, Wolf Brand chili, and canned hominy with sausage and onions liberally laced with ketchup, molasses, and a glug of cider vinegar. Buddy had ordered a folding cot, $2.89, from the Sears and Roebuck catalog, and Wayne slept on it in the pantry, which Buddy thought was a pretty good plan, all things considered. Having Wayne sleeping on the premises meant that he was handy to answer the telephone or go to the door if a citizen came banging on it in the middle of the night, which almost never happened, because most Darling folks went to bed early and stayed there, barring emergencies. But it allowed Buddy to brag that the Cypress County Sheriff's Office was staffed around the clock. As Buddy tossed his uniform hat onto the peg beside the door, he heard the clackety-clack of a typewriter. "That you, Springer?" he called. The typing stopped. "Not me," Wayne said. "It's some guy from the Internal Revenue Service. He's here to arrest you for skipping out on your income taxes. I'm letting him use my typewriter to type the summons he's going to serve on you." The typing resumed. "He'll have to prove I have an income first," Buddy countered. He went into the kitchen and filled a white china mug with coffee from the percolator on the back of the stove. Being sheriff might sound like a glamorous job, and Roy Burns had never seemed to hurt for money. In fact, he lived in a very nice house. His wife had a full-time cook and housekeeper, and they owned a vacation cottage down at Oyster Bay where Roy kept a 30-foot fishing boat with a monster Evinrude outboard motor. Buddy wasn't so lucky. After he paid Mrs. Beadle for his upstairs room, breakfast included, hot bath once a week, laundry twice a month, there was just enough left to take Bettina to the Darling Diner for Friday night supper and then to the Palace for a movie. Or a movie plus popcorn and a box of jujubes and two orange knee-high sodas and skip supper at the diner. Bettina offered to pay half, but the thought of such a thing scandalized him.
Other guys could mooch if they wanted to, but he had more self-respect. His girl would never pay one red cent out of her pocket. The night before, they had gone to see a real thriller diller, King Kong. Buddy figured that the climb all the way to the top of the new Empire State Building had to involve some pretty slick camera trickery, but he couldn't dope out how they managed to film the fight between the ape and that dinosaur. Bettina had hit her pretty face against his arm all the way through that scene, which was worth the price of admission all by itself. He took his coffee into Wayne's office. A small silver-toned battery radio sat on the shelf behind the desk, playing Rudy Valley's hit recording, "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" Wayne had stopped typing and was leaning back in his chair, his eyes closed, doing a pretty good Valley imitation. Once in khaki suits, Jiwee looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly dumb. Half a million boots went slogging through hell.
"Not exactly the most cheerful song in the book," Buddy said.
He had once heard Wayne singing Old Man River while he stirred a pot of fatback, beans, and cabbage, and had thought he was good enough to sing on the radio. Come to think of it, Old Man River was melancholy, too, in a different way.
"Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land in jail."
Wayne broke off. He opened his eyes, dark in his sunburned face, those high cheekbones giving him an enigmatic look. His glance flicked to Buddy standing in the doorway.
"Hey," he said. "Just heard on the radio that the feds finally got Pretty Boy Floyd."
Buddy whistled in surprise. After the Kansas City massacre the year before, J. Edgar Hoover had named Floyd public enemy number one. Ordinary folks, though, admired Pretty Boy's lawless ways. In Oklahoma, where he grew up, some newspaper reporter had called him the Robin Hood of the Cookson Hills, and the name had stuck. He gave money away, and when he robbed a bank, he also destroyed the mortgage files, effectively shutting down its foreclosures.
"They cornered him in some woods in Ohio," Wayne said. "Shot him dead."
He looked down at the Royal typewriter on the table in front of him.
"I'm working on the Whitworth auto crash report. Give me 10 minutes and I'll have it on your desk."
"Turn up anything interesting?" Buddy asked, sipping his coffee. He grimaced. He wasn't crazy about Wayne's coffee, which was strong enough to stop an elephant, but he didn't dislike it enough to go to the trouble of making another pot just for himself.
"Maybe."
Wayne gestured to a short stack of photographic prints.
"Charlie Dickens brought these over. Pictures he took at the wreck site this morning."
He quirked an eyebrow.
"Foot of Spook Hill. I understand you know the place."
"Yeah.
There have been several accidents out there over the past couple of years."
Buddy frowned.
"How did Dickens come to find out about the wreck?"
He liked Charlie, and sometimes he was a help. He'd put notices and such in the Dispatch for free, and it helped to have the local newspaper on your side when it came to an unpleasant story, like the time he'd dumped Pootie's load of shine. But he wouldn't tell you where he'd heard something.
"Protecting my sources," was the way he put it, which was frustrating when Buddy thought he really ought to hand that information over.
And he could be a nuisance. When something important was happening, he didn't mind getting in the way.
"Lucy Murphy called it in to him," Wayne said. "She called here first, then the newspaper."
He pulled a flat can of Prince Albert out of his hip pocket and a pack of cigarette papers out of his shirt pocket. Deftly, he began to fashion a cigarette.
"Gotta say, I was glad he showed up. He had his camera with him. Caught some things we might have missed."
"Yeah? Like what?"
"Ruts in the road. They gave a clue as to how come Whitworth went over the embankment."
He shook tobacco into his folded cigarette paper.
"And the crease in the rear end of his Pierce Arrow."
"Crease?"
Buddy frowned.
"Yeah, a fair-sized dent, actually."
Wayne finished rolling, licked the length of the cigarette to seal it, and stuck it in his mouth. He reached across the table for the stack of photos, leafed through them, and pulled one out.
"There,"
he said, and jabbed a finger at the photo.
"Huh,"
Buddy said.
He bent over it, frowning. He was looking at a picture of the rear end of the once stately old automobile, no longer the proud beauty it had been. It was sitting upright on all four wheels, but the top was smashed against the top of the seats. He shivered. No chance for the driver to survive. And there it was, a shallow, horizontal dent, a crease, as Wayne put it, a couple of inches above the rear bumper.
You think...
But Buddy didn't need to finish the sentence. He knew what Wayne thought, that somebody had driven up behind the Pierce Arrow, whacked it smartly, and sent it careening down that steep hill. He looked again.
This dent could have been made any time, you know, last week, last month, before. Not necessarily last night, and not on that hill. Could have happened anywhere.
Don't think so.
Wayne scratched a match against his boot heel and lit his cigarette.
It was pretty muddy out there. There's mud splatters all over that car. But when I've seen him driving around town, that baby has always been clean as a whistle, sparkly and shiny as a new penny.
He pulled on his cigarette.
In fact, Whitworth paid Jake Pritchard to keep it washed and polished, like he was going to a wedding every day of the week, Jake says.
So you talked to Jake?
That was what Buddy liked about Wayne. He was an independent thinker. When he got an idea, he followed wherever it took him without anybody having to tell him to do one thing or another. Old Roy Burns, he hadn't liked that in a deputy. He liked a man who didn't do a thing until he was told to do it, which had frustrated Buddy. Wayne nodded.
Yeah, I gave Jake a call a little while ago. He washed that car yesterday afternoon, himself. Shined up that old Pierce Arrow real pretty. Swears there was no dent. Says a dent in that precious auto of Whitworth's would have made him blow a fuse.
So your theory, there's more.
He took another photo from the stack.
That road out there was nothing but Alabama mud and slick as the devil. See these ruts? Looks to me like somebody braked hard right here and skidded sort of sideways. Could have happened when it hit that Pierce Arrow hard enough to send it downhill and down the embankment.
He paused.
That's my theory anyway, for what it's worth.
Buddy looked.
I see what you're saying, Wayne. So you think we're looking for another car?
He was leaving to call on Mrs. Whitworth just as the tractor towing the wreck had arrived. He had directed them to the alley.
They parked the wreck out by the fence?
Yeah, it was there when I got back from dropping Whitworth off at the funeral parlor.
He paused, shaking his head.
Poor fella's face is pretty much of a mess. Smashed against the steering wheel from the looks of it. His best friend probably wouldn't know him. Lionel doesn't think he can fix him up decent, he added. Says it'll have to be a closed casket funeral.
Folks won't like that, Buddy said.
Darling folks liked to see their friends and loved ones laid out face up, just to make sure they were burying the right one. They were superstitious that way. He looked down at the photo of the crease in the car's rear end.
Any other damage to the car? Bullet holes?
Sounded like a frivolous question, maybe, but it wasn't. If another vehicle had been pursuing Whitworth, there might have been shooting. He thought of what Mrs. Whitworth had said. If Bodine Pyle had been involved, shooting wouldn't surprise him. He guessed that half the homicides in Alabama were related to bootlegging. Moonshine was a violent business. Stick your nose in where it wasn't wanted, you'd get it shot off.
Nope, no bullet holes in the vehicle, Wayne said. I also took a good look at Whitworth when Noonan got him on the mortuary table. Doc Roberts will tell us for sure, but I couldn't see any bullet holes in him either.
Wayne squinted through the smoke of his cigarette.
You're thinking of Bodine Pyle, I reckon.
You read my mind,
Buddy gave him an appraising look.
How'd you know? Charlie Dickens passed on some rumors when he brought the photos over here. He's heard that Whitworth was a partner in Pyle's moonshine operation.
He quirked an eyebrow.
How'd you find out?
Heard it mentioned at the diner this morning, Buddy said.
I wasn't sure I believed it.
Whitworth always looked like a straight-up citizen to me, but Ms. Whitworth confirmed it. She doesn't much like the idea. I don't wonder. Husband involved in a shady racket doesn't look good for her.
Cigarette dangling from one corner of his mouth, Wayne restored the photos to the stack and put the lot into a manila envelope.
Did you take her to Noonan's to identify her husband?
She didn't want to go. Buddy frowned.
Jed Snow's wife told me that Ms. Whitworth was thinking about getting a divorce. She's apparently already talked to Mosley about it.
Interesting, Wayne said briefly. He jerked his head.
Car's out back, on the alley.
The wrecked Pierce Arrow squatted forlornly in a corner of the yard, under a green canvas tarp. Wayne pulled it off, and Buddy shook his head sadly. Up close and personal, the damage looked worse than it had in Charlie's photo. The elegant old car was completely wrecked, and there was a good deal of blood mixed with the red mud splashed on the driver's door. No bullet or buckshot damage, though, just that unmistakable crease. And looking at that dent, Buddy decided that Wayne's theory was quite reasonable. At some point, somebody had driven up behind the car and given it a right smart smack. Had it been done carelessly or deliberately? A bad driver or somebody with a grudge? But however it had happened, the impact could have sent the Pierce Arrow careening out of control and over the embankment, which could turn an accidental death into manslaughter at a minimum. The question was, who? Back in the office with a second cup of coffee, Buddy sat down at his desk and took his notebook out of his shirt pocket. The beast followed him in, jumped gracefully onto the windowsill, and began washing his right paw with a bright pink tongue. Buddy regarded the cat for a moment. Gravely, he said,
"You go back down where you came from and get Roy Burns to tell you who was driving that car, the one that hit Whitworth's Pierce Arrow last night."
The beast put his paw down and stared at him with those burnt copper eyes. He didn't say anything. After a moment, he began washing his left paw. With a sigh, Buddy turned to a clean page in his notebook and wrote pile at the top of the page, and moonshine. Under that, he wrote warden. He frowned, thought, and wrote Burford, although he wasn't sure that was how the man spelled his name. Then he thought some more, remembered the widow's lie about the divorce, and wrote Ms. Whitworth. He frowned, remembering something else Ophelia Snow had told him, which hadn't really registered at the time. After the name, he wrote, "new car," and added a question mark, and hadn't Ophelia also said something about Mrs. Whitworth being a terrible driver? He added another question mark. He was still considering this list when the front screen door slammed and a sharp female voice shrilled, "Yoo-hoo, Sheriff! Is anybody here? It's me!" Buddy sighed. He knew who me was, and he fervently wished she would go away. But he also knew she wouldn't, so he closed his notebook and raised his voice. "I'm in the office, Ms. Adcock." The woman who came in, a sharp-chinned woman with a prissy mouth and squinty gray eyes, was wearing a bright purple dress, purple gloves, and a purple hat. Over the past few months, Leona Ruth Adcock had taken a liking to the new sheriff and had gotten into the habit of bringing him tips that she hoped might help him solve crimes. Indeed, one of her tips had resulted in the return of four disgracefully overdue library books to a grateful Miss Rogers at the Darling Library, which Buddy didn't count as much of a crime. As a tipster, Leona Ruth was only marginally useful. She was a sponge. Everywhere she went, she soaked up bits of this and that and mixed and mingled and mangled all of it with her own imagination. When she came to him with a story, it was impossible to tell what part of it, if any, was factual. Still, he had to listen to her. It was his job.
"How are you today, Ms. Adcock?" Buddy said with a phony heartiness and waved his hand toward a chair. "Sit down and rest yourself a bit."
"Believe I will, thank you," Leona Ruth said and settled herself on the other side of Buddy's desk.
This won't take long, Sheriff. I just stopped in to tell you that Mr. Whitworth didn't get himself killed in any accident. It was deliberate.
She gave a sharp nod, and the peacock feathers fluttered on her hat, their markings looking remarkably like a pair of large, iridescent blue eyes encircled in green.
I know it for a fact.
You do? Normally, Buddy would have been skeptical. In this case, however, the lady might be on to something. So far as he knew, he and Wayne were the only ones aware of that dent in the back of Whitworth's wrecked car.
Yes, I certainly do, she said emphatically. Mrs. Audrey Dunlap thinks her husband killed him.
Buddy's jaw dropped. Mrs. Dunlap? You mean Liz Lacey's mother? The one who...
Exactly, Leona Ruth said with satisfaction. Mrs. Dunlap, who recently married Mr. Dunlap from the Five and Dime. I learned this just a little while ago, and I've been thinking about it ever since. I finally decided that it was my duty as a concerned citizen to tell you.
She gave a nervous look at the beast, who was staring at her with a fixed concentration.
That cat, he is certainly a malevolent creature.
He's just an old cat, Buddy said. Astray. Don't pay any attention to him.
Why would Mr. Dunlap? Because Mr. Whitworth was his partner. That's why.
Leona Ruth leaned forward and lowered her voice,
which Mrs. Dunlap just found out about.
I see, Buddy said. Armed with Myra May's tip, he had already been down that road. He had talked to Mr. Dunlap that morning, while Mr. Whitworth was still just a missing person. Dunlap had told him that Whitworth had come over for a few minutes the evening before to talk about the upcoming barbershop competition. Nothing suspicious there. He cleared his throat.
Did Mrs. Dunlap say why she thought her husband might have wanted to...
Because there was a fight! Leona Ruth said with relish.
It seems that a ways back, Mr. Dunlap signed a paper saying that the $1,000 he got from Mr. Whitworth for his store was all he was ever going to get, while Mr. Whitworth would get his share of the profits forever. Doesn't seem right to me, but that's the way it is.
Buddy nodded. It was the situation that Myra May had described that morning.
It's called a limited partnership.
Whatever, Leona Ruth waved her hand. Doesn't make it right. Anyway, Audrey, that's Mrs. Dunlap, she told me that Mr. Dunlap asked Mr. Whitworth to chip in on a new heating system. Mr. Whitworth said no, he wasn't putting in any more money. They got into a big argument. Worse than that, there was pushing and shoving, Audrey said. After Mr. Whitworth left, Mr. Dunlap was so upset that he went for a long drive to calm himself. He wouldn't let Audrey go with him, and he didn't get home until midnight, and after that, he paced around the house all night and wouldn't eat Sally Lou's apple pancakes for breakfast, which Audrey says he has never done before.
I understand, Buddy said, and I'm glad to know all that. But does Mrs. Dunlap have any concrete evidence that her husband actually...
We didn't go into that, Leona Ruth said, very prim. Poor Audrey was terribly upset, and I didn't feel I should make it worse by asking questions.
She looked down at her purple-gloved hands folded in her purple lap.
Of course, she would never tell you a word of this herself, she added righteously. But I felt I had to. It was my civic responsibility.
The peacock feathers on her hat trembled with the force of her conviction. Buddy took a deep breath.
Well, I'm glad you did, Miss Adcock, he said. I'll be sure and check into it.
Leona Ruth raised her head and fixed him with her eyes.
But I sincerely hope and trust that you won't tell dear Audrey that I was the one who told you. I mean, I wouldn't want her to think.
But that was as far as she got. For as Leona Ruth raised her head, her peacock feathers shimmered, their eyes twinkled enticingly, and the beast launched himself into the air, closing the gap between himself and Leona Ruth's hat in one powerful leap, its force carrying both him and the hat halfway across the room. It took quite a while to calm Leona Ruth's hysterics, rescue her battered, defeathered hat, and banish the beast. Afterward, Buddy escorted her out to the sheriff's squad car and drove her home, still sniffling into her handkerchief. He walked her to her door, took off his hat, and solemnly thanked her again.
"Speaking as the sheriff," he said, "it's just real good to know that the law in this town can count on people like you."
"Thank you," she said. "I consider it my duty."
Back in the office, he opened a fresh can of tuna fish, whistled for the beast, and watched while the cat made short work of an extra large helping. Chapter 17. Ophelia, Liz, and Charlie. Ophelia's husband Jed was always cautioning her against poking her nose into things that weren't her business, but she had never been able to corral her curiosity once it got a bit between its teeth. And while she felt downright sorry for Regina Whitworth, even if the poor thing was planning to divorce her husband, it must have been terrible to lose him in the blink of an eye, as it were, she was still puzzling over several unanswered questions. Which was nothing new, of course, for Ophelia often spent whole days trying to unravel variously twisted skeins of thought that led her here, there, and everywhere. She had never been what anybody would call an organized thinker, although in her own considered opinion, this was an asset, because it sometimes led to conclusions that a more orderly thinker might miss. And, for another thing, Ophelia had not once during her expedition with the sheriff taken her reporter's notebook out of her handbag, and she had almost no little bits of human interest story to soften Charlie Dickens' report of the accident. While there was that intriguing business about Mr. Whitworth's being a silent partner in Bodine Pyle's moonshine operation, that didn't exactly qualify as human interest, did it? And Regina's little white lie about the divorce, well, that didn't count either. The sheriff was right when he said it wasn't related to Mr. Whitworth's accident, at least not on the surface and not in any way that Ophelia could easily see. And anyway, Charlie couldn't use it. Divorce was one of those words Darling didn't like to read in its newspaper. So, when Sheriff Norris let her out of his car in front of the dispatch office, Ophelia stood for a moment on the sidewalk, trying to decide what to do next. She hated to confess to Charlie that her errand, for which she had given up that meeting with the men of the Share the Wealth Society, had not been as productive as he hoped. She needed to talk this over with somebody who could help her think this through. Liz Lacey, that's who she would talk to. And having made up her mind, she turned, crossed the street, and headed straight for the bed of bright fall annuals, purple asters, orange marigolds, red zinnias, and yellow chrysanthemums, blooming with a burst of color in a corner of the courthouse lawn. As a dahlia, she had helped plant that bed, along with Aunt Hetty Little and Bessie Bloodworth. She had weeded it, too, which made them her flowers more than anybody else's. She bent over and began to pick a bouquet. Upstairs at her desk in Mr. Mosley's law office, Lizzie was talking to Mrs. Ellie Sue Slim, who had a legal problem. "I'm so sorry you've had this trouble," she said soothingly. "I've written down everything you've told me, and I'll let Mr. Mosley know about it the minute he gets back to town. But in the meantime, maybe you could have a talk with the sheriff." The woman, seated in the chair on the other side of Lizzie's desk, was wearing a plain cotton house dress and no gloves, and her going-to-town straw hat was trimmed with a wilted-looking red crepe paper rose.
"I did that yesterday," Mrs. Slim said. "The sheriff says it's a civil matter, which ain't the same as criminal, so he can't do anything about it, or won't," she added with weary resignation. which amounts to the same thing, I reckon. The sheriff says I should take Tom Jerkins to court to make him pay what he owes me for that mule. He's a good mule with a lot of years left on him. She unsnapped her pocketbook. I've got a bill of sale right here with Tom Jerkins' name on it and the date, all legal. There's more than half owing on that mule, and I purely do need that money.
Tom Jerkins. The name rang a bell, Lizzie thought. Mr. Mosley had dealt with him earlier when he had tried to skip out on another debt.
It's good that you have the bill of sale, she said. You hang on to it until you've talked to Mr. Mosley. How can he get in touch with you?
The woman looked down at her chapped, work-worn hands.
Don't have no phone. But you can call my near neighbor, Stella Parnell, and she'll send her little girl across the road to get me. Her number is Evergreen 237.
Thank you. Lizzie wrote it down. EV-237. I'll tell him. Mrs. Slim's complaint against Tom Jerkins was typical of the things people asked Mr. Mosley to do for them, drawing up property deeds, making wills, collecting debts, mediating disagreements. Small-time, small-town work. But Mr. Mosley preferred it, he said, to the big city clients he had in Montgomery and Mobile, who were often intentionally crooked, and hired him to clean up their criminal messes. But the trouble was that Mr. Mosley's darling clients didn't always have cash to pay their legal bills, which meant that they paid in whatever they had of value. The week before, a farmer in bib overalls had brought in two fat Rhode Island red hens.
"These'll make real good chicken and dumplings," he said, handing them to Lizzie.
Mr. Mosley, with an eye to a more durable reward than a Sunday dinner, donated the hens to Lizzie's backyard flock, where they would lay eggs for breakfasts for the two of them, with plenty leftovers for the darling blessing box. The unfortunate thing, of course, was that people who paid their bill in chickens weren't paying Lizzie's salary, which was why Mr. Mosley was thinking of reducing her hours. The door opened, and Lizzie saw that it was Ophelia.
"Oh, hello, Mrs. Snow," she said brightly. "I'll be with you in just a minute."
Mrs. Slim stood.
"You tell Mr. Mosley."
Her crooked smile showed a missing tooth.
"I'll sure thank him if he can help me get the rest of the money. That mule is a good mule."
Lizzie stood and held out her hand. "You'll hear from him soon," she promised with a smile. When the woman had gone, she turned to Ophelia.
"Hey, Opie, nice to see you."
She gave her friend an appreciative glance. Ophelia didn't spend much money on her clothes, but she always looked neat and fresh. Today, her pink and white belted seersucker dress and pink sweater looked both feminine and professional, and she was carrying a small bouquet of bright flowers.
"For you," Ophelia said, holding them out. "For your desk."
"Oh, how lovely," Lizzie exclaimed. "Thank you." She buried her nose in the flowers and breathed deeply. The marigolds had a distinctive fragrance that always reminded her of a summer garden on a hot, sunshine-blessed day.
"What's the occasion?"
"No occasion," Ophelia gave a little shrug.
"You know what Aunt Hetty always says, all it takes to be happy is good health and a little bunch of flowers."
She raised an eyebrow.
"And I just might have a question or two that you could answer, if you have a few minutes."
Lizzie smiled. "I do, but I'll put these in water first." She got up.
"Would you like some coffee?"
"I'd love a cup,"
Ophelia said, and took the chair Mrs. Slim had vacated. Lizzie filled a small crystal vase with water and arranged the flowers. With coffee, the flowers, and a tin of cookies, she went back to her desk.
"I want you to try one of my chocolate crunch cookies."
She opened the tin. "They've got little chunks of chip chocolate in them."
"Chip chocolate?"
Opie took a cookie.
"Right. The story goes that a lady named Ruth Wakefield, somewhere up in Massachusetts, invented the recipe by accident a couple of years ago. She planned to make some chocolate cookies, but she was out of baking chocolate. She did have a chunk of semi-sweet chocolate, though, so she chipped off some little pieces, about a cup or so. She expected the chips to melt into the dough the way regular baking chocolate would, but they didn't. Instead, they mostly stayed the way they were, little chips of chocolate, but sort of soft and gooey. She called it the chocolate crunch cookie."
I heard the recipe on the Betty Crocker radio program a couple of weeks ago. She paused to nibble a cookie. What do you think?
It's swell, Ophelia said delightedly, munching. Little chips of chocolate. I know my kids would love it. Jed, too. Will you give me the recipe?
Of course, Lizzie said and picked up her coffee cup. So, what's going on? She eyed the flowers on the corner of her desk. She wanted to ask, again, what they were for, but she figured that Opie would get around to telling her. Ophelia held up her reporter's notebook.
Actually, I'm working on the Whitworth story for Charlie. I've just been talking to Regina Whitworth with the sheriff, she added importantly.
The sheriff? Lizzie frowned. This sounded serious.
Then he hasn't turned up yet? Mr. Whitworth, I mean.
Turned up? Ophelia frowned.
I guess you haven't heard then.
I've been behind this desk for most of the day, Lizzie said. I brought my lunch, so I haven't been out. She broke off.
Heard what, Opie?
Why, Mr. Whitworth is dead, Liz. He was killed in an automobile crash out on Spook Hill. His body was found this morning.
Dead?
Lizzie set her coffee down so hard the coffee almost sloshed over.
Oh, no, she exclaimed, feeling breathless. How terrible. Had he been kidnapped?
Kidnapped? Ophelia asked quizzically.
My gracious, Liz, why in the world would you think that?
I didn't, exactly, Lizzie said. Mrs. Whitworth brought it up when I talked to her this morning.
You talked to her?
Yes, Lizzie said.
She called here quite early wanting to talk to Mr. Mosley. She seemed upset, so I gave her his number in Montgomery. After he talked to her, he called to tell me that Mr. Whitworth hadn't come home last night. He wanted me to go over there and see if I could help.
I must tell Mr. Mosley about Mr. Whitworth, she thought. But I don't suppose there's any huge hurry. Now that her husband is dead, Mrs. Whitworth won't be getting a divorce.
Aloud, she said, So you're writing the story for the Dispatch?
Ophelia shook her head regretfully.
You know Charlie. He always keeps the best for himself. But the sheriff thought he ought to take a woman along when he went to tell Mrs. Whitworth what had happened, so Charlie suggested me. He asked me to collect some human interest bits that he can use in the story.
She looked glum. I didn't do so well with that assignment, I'm afraid.
Lizzie leaned forward, feeling concerned. How did Mrs. Whitworth take the news? Is she okay? Is anyone with her?
She took a breath, thinking out loud.
Mr. Mosley will probably want to go over there again and offer to help with arrangements.
She must be Mr. Mosley's client, then, Ophelia said quickly. I suppose she consulted him on the divorce?
Lizzie was surprised. You know about that? How did you find out?
She told me herself last week, Ophelia said.
We had to go to Monroeville on an errand for the Ladies' Guild. She drove her new car, that gorgeous pumpkin-colored Dodge she bought from Kilgore's.
Her new car?
Ah,
Lizzie murmured, remembering. She had glimpsed that car in the Whitworth's garage that morning, but she hadn't known it belonged to Mrs. Whitworth.
Ophelia went on. Anyway, she wanted to talk about the divorce when we stopped for root beer. I got the impression that she was looking forward to a new life, maybe even to getting out of Darling. She frowned. But it was odd, Liz. When I mentioned the divorce in front of the sheriff, she denied it, heatedly.
That is odd, Lizzie said. I wonder why she did that.
She bit her lip. Maybe she shouldn't be discussing this with Opie. But now that Mr. Whitworth was dead, there wouldn't be a divorce. Maybe Mrs. Whitworth was no longer a client.
If that was true, was the subject still covered by client privilege? Anyway, Ophelia seemed to know all about it.
That's exactly what I said. Ophelia was emphatic.
She's wrong, or more accurately, she's lying.
She added, If you ask me, she didn't want the sheriff to suspect that she might have a motive.
A motive for what? Lizzie asked blankly. Ophelia gave her a defensive look.
Well, her husband did die rather suddenly.
But you said it was an accident, Lizzie pressed. An automobile crash. Crashes tend to happen suddenly, don't they?
Yes, but...
Ophelia waved a hand.
Accidents do have a